You know, it's these people who look kind of uncomfortable, and they're supposed to look happy. And that clearly is the case. It's supposed to be some sort of happy scene. And then there's this off-screen voice, you know.
Don't let the camera catch you looking bad.
That's right. That's right. You know, less fake. Less fake.
Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. Today, J. Robert Parks and I will be talking about a documentary called The Act of Killing. The show notes for this episode are at plasticpodcast.com.
Hey, J. Robert.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Good. So, we watched a movie called The Act of Killing, which is a documentary. And as the titles explain at the very beginning, in Indonesia, there was a military coup that overthrew the government, and this was in 1965. And that the military and gangsters, as they're called, who overthrew the government, have been in power ever since. And as a result of that, you can ask them about the things that they did then, and they're surprisingly proud of having killed lots and lots of communists.
That's right.
In quite brutal ways. And so this documentarian, Joshua Oppenheimer, had the idea of finding a couple of them and asking them to recreate, using cinema, whatever scenes they wanted, basically restaging, making a movie about this. And so it's about all the prep work of them sort of planning it, finding actors, finding, you know, setting the scenes, doing shooting the scenes in some cases, which he's capturing with his camera. And the result is, the result of the process, I guess I should say, the process is fascinating in many ways. It's really disturbing in a lot of ways because these are guys who've never been taken to task for this.
And don't fear being taken to task for it.
They speak openly about it, and it's so long ago, 40 years ago, that they don't feel there's any sort of legal repercussions that could ever happen. But even just the fact that their side sort of has been in power since then, they've never sort of had to hear from the people who were affected by all of that directly.
So. Yeah, it is, and it's interesting. I mean, there's been lots of movies, some great movies, about sort of atrocities, you know, World War II and other wars as well. But this one, because it is taken from the point of view of the perpetrators, although we do hear from some of the victims in really astonishing ways, but because it's mostly from the view of the perpetrators, it's a very different feel, I think, than a lot of those other movies. And the sense of the fact they're doing these reenactments, and some of them are very straightforward, but others of them are very stylized. The movie opens with this really strange scene, and particularly because you don't know what you're watching at first, of these people in front of a waterfall, and this music is being played, this sort of very syrupy music is being played, and there's some guy, some director in the background sort of shouting at them, you know, act more natural, less fake, I think is the phrase. But there's lots of scenes like this that are sort of odd, and you're trying to think, what's going on here? I don't know. I found it's both more disturbing in certain ways, but also more compelling because of that than maybe sort of a standard approach would have been. So,
yeah, the most troubling scenes are when they talk about how specifically they killed people. And in some cases, the guy who's telling us, he claims that he killed 1,000 this way, and then everybody seems to back him up. This seems to be fact. And he literally shows us with a wire and around someone's neck how he did it, and sort of reenacts the gusto with which he pulled on that cord to tighten it against someone's neck, and why he did it that way instead of another way, because they had tried this other way and it produced
too much blood.
And this way was more effective and easier to clean up. And it's really, to hear someone just for a while talking with no remorse about any of this is really disturbing. I immediately thought of S21, the Khmer Rouge killing machine. A documentary by Rithi Pan that's about, the Khmer Rouge were ruling Cambodia with an iron fist, and there were similar sorts of things happening in their prison camps. And he had this idea of having a couple of the people who actually survived those prisons talk with some of the people who were guards there. And in society, they were peers, and yet in this situation, they were, you know, hugely opposed. And he even had some of them, he didn't have a lot of footage of that, but he had the guards sort of reenact some of their daily routines, and the way they fell into this sort of showmanship was really surprising and chilling. And in that case, they had the victims there also, one of which was a painter and was very articulate and able to sort of, he had this very controlled and contained rage, I felt. was able to really question them and interrogate them in a more humane way than he was probably interrogated back then. But this movie has a lot of those same elements.
It does.
It's a much more elaborate thing that they're doing. It's not falling into a little bit of role play, but it's actually, let's try to reconstruct as much as we can. And I don't know what the filmmaker was really hoping would happen, but what did happen was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's so there's two main characters that the movie focuses on, Anwar and Herman. And Anwar seems to be maybe the brains behind the operation so much, and Herman is definitely the heavy. But it's the relationship of those two guys as they talk both about what they did in the past, but also what they do in the present. I mean, in a way, they're gangsters today, and they're proud of that name. They associate with the idea of being free. To be a gangster is to be able to do what you want.
Yeah, their word is free men. They're
that's
free
right.
men, and it comes from English, and it means they're free to do what they want.
Yeah, free to do what they want, and so we see them extorting. We see them going down to shopkeepers and shaking people down. You know, in the present day, and we see them still being involved in, even though Indonesia is more of a democracy now, since the previous regime was finally pushed out. But still, paramilitary organizations are still common, and sort of, you know, organized with impunity. And so it's interesting to sort of see how people who were, you know, killers and simply killers have become almost, in certain ways, respected members of society, and to sort of see how, you know, they're treated and where they are and how people still fear them. I mean, clearly people still fear them. We sort of see that in lots of different scenes is disturbing too.
Yeah, they say that one reason that they are motivated to be in this project is that they think that kids should know their history. And it just feels so backwards. Well, I'm not sure that they want your take on this. It's really surprising that they have this view, and it makes me feel that the movie itself was a bit of an ambush. I mean, clearly the filmmaker didn't tell them he was going to hold them up and try to bring them to justice in some small way here in his film. They took what he said at face value that they were going to, you know, glamorize the stuff. But even just letting them do that, some of them do feel a little funny at times, especially when there are other people who are their neighbors or whatever who say, well, you know. Yeah, my dad was a communist and was killed by you guys.
Right.
And you know, I know that I'm supposed to be glad that we killed the communists as a country, but I have mixed feelings about this. You know, when he starts talking about it, they have these reasons for why, well, we can't include that in the movie. That story would be too long and complicated. Mm. Or we'd be rewriting history, and it's not good to rewrite history, and you know.
Yeah, there's that scene that you're mentioning takes place, I want to say, about in the middle of the movie. It's probably the most powerful scene in the film for me. But they're practicing. We see a lot of some of the scenes we see are, you know, what appear to be kind of finished scenes for this movie that they're ostensibly making. But a lot of the movie is them practicing and so they're getting different people who are going to be extras or even actors in their movie. And at one point they're acting out an interrogation scene, and one of the guys starts talking about his stepdad. Yeah, you know, you came and took my stepdad away, and we never saw him again. And the way he describes this, he's trying to sort of almost make light of it, not like it's a joke, but like it's no big deal. Yeah, this happened.
He laughs several times.
He laughs several times, but as the scene goes on, it becomes more and more disturbing as he sort of describes this story. And by the end, he's, if I remember right, he's just weeping. I mean, it's, you know, he's sort of overcome by the retelling of it. And then everyone else in the room sort of realizes, you know, what the ramifications of what they're doing, in ways that I think are uncomfortable for everyone, but are really powerful for the film.
Yeah. I mean, even one of the main guys, although they sort of seem proud of this when they're talking, in interviews and stuff, he's had nightmares for a long time. Mm-hmm. And even as far back as when it was sort of happening, his mom told him that he needs to pray before he goes to bed. And, you know, there's this sense of maybe you need to cleanse. But even to this day, you know, he still feels like he has nightmares. And, you know, another guy who's involved says that he should see a psychiatrist or a neurologist and get some nerve pills, and it'll help calm him down. They eventually try to dramatize his dreams as well to try to visualize what those feel like to him.
Yeah. It you mentioned S21, which I think is a really great sort of parallel to this. The documentaries that I kind of thought of as I was watching this were it reminds me a lot of a Herzog film, a Werner Herzog film, in the way that Herzog is fascinated with, you know, sort of people who are just unusual, so people who are different, and the two guys at the center of this are really quite unusual and different. I mean, you know, Herman is a traditional heavy, and yet he clearly enjoys cross-dressing. You know, there's lots of different scenes in the movie where he's dressed in a kind of a garish, you know, woman's outfit and with makeup, and he's like, what's going on here? But what it also reminded me of was the documentaries of Steve James, Hoop Dreams, The Interrupters, and Stevie in particular, in the way that the Oppenheimer, the director of this film, gives you that sort of fly on the wall quality, that somehow he's getting people to do things and then just filming them. And it's like, you can't believe that anyone is doing this while they're being filmed, because it feels like they are completely oblivious to the camera sometimes. And they're doing things that's like, wow, I don't think I would do that if I were being filmed. And yet he just lets the camera roll and gets this amazing footage I think there's a skill to that. You know, it's because I just see so few documentarians able to do that, to, you know, sort of let the camera roll and really get something that feels truthful and vulnerable and just gets to the heart of whatever, you know, they're trying to do.
Yeah, if these guys get the sense that something is up, mm-hmm. Then they're going to put up their guard.
That's right.
It'll be a very different kind of thing. You have to sort of catch them at whatever it is that they're feeling or wanting to project. Yeah, I think it's important to think about the effect that movies have on this entire thing, because a lot of these guys, apparently they tell us that many of the gangsters were recruited from the movie gangsters. They were these guys who would scalp movie tickets and then use the funds for whatever their illicit activities were. And that's where a lot of these guys came from. And they seem proud of the fact that they were influenced in their methods by movies.
Mm-hmm.
And really the effect of movies pervades this entire thing, because the entire project is to make a movie, but we're also watching a movie that I think a filmmaker, a documentarian, hopes will have a certain sort of gut-punching conclusion that he's banking on here at the end. And I think that does happen, because he shows early cuts of the film to the participants and gets their reactions. The first time, it's a very, you can almost see the armor go up whenever, you know, you watch these scenes of these really gruesome, what would have been gruesome killings being recreated. And he's watching them and trying to read his blank face is tricky.
Yeah.
But then what he talks about is, you know what, I shouldn't have worn white pants in that, because I wouldn't have worn white pants. It would have been ridiculous, because I would have been covered in blood. I always wear dark pants.
Yeah.
Back then, we need to remember that. Mm. And it feels callous, but I also almost feel like it was a shell being put up of...
Yeah, a defense mechanism.
Almost. Yeah, I'm detaching from this. I'm going to think about a mundane detail.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not go down that path. Well, the movie's going to go down that path.
Yeah.
And so later, when he sees a fuller cut of it... I guess we'll say this is a spoiler, but he has a very, very strong reaction. Mm-hmm. He begins to feel that maybe I did something wrong. And he's prompted by some questions from Oppenheimer, who says, what triggers it is he says, you know, when I was playing in that scene and I was playing the guy who was getting killed, I feel so badly.
Mm.
And the filmmaker tells him, you know, the people who actually went through it felt a lot worse, because they knew they were being killed. It's like there's an order of magnitude difference here.
Right.
And then he begins to break down.
Yep.
But I have to remember that this is a movie we're watching. This is a guy who's told us over and over again he's influenced by movies. He sort of knows, if he gets a sense of how the filmmaker wants to steer things via these questions, how sincere is his breakdown, or does he feel like, that's the conclusion that we want for this?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because for me, that feels like the one false note in the movie. All the rest of the movie seems to really ring true for me, except for that sort of moment of catharsis towards the end. Because it does feel a little bit like acting. But it also feels like, at least on the director's part, but maybe also on Anwar's part, a sense that this is what the audience wants, right? I mean, you know, when we watch these kinds of movies, and Act of Killing is just one of many, I mean... there's often sort of a build-up to some moment of catharsis, because what we're watching is really horrible on screen, or what we're hearing about is really terrible to kind of think about. And most people don't just want to come to the end of that and feel this, emptiness that comes with being confronted by evil for 2 hours. And so then we have to build to something that gives us some sort of breakthrough, some sense of reckoning, some sense of, people coming to terms with their own actions. And this feels like that scene, but it doesn't feel earned to me. It feels manipulated to me. And I sort of found myself recoiling a bit from the movie at that point, because it felt like, oh yeah, I guess this is what we have to have. We have to have this so that people feel better about themselves as they go towards the end. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's how it felt to you.
Well, initially I felt, finally, we're seeing a glimmer of this. That's the motor that drives a movie like that, is that impulse of, yes, finally, we're going to get some acknowledgement. But that's why the scene is there, is because it's going to provoke that response in me. And so I agree with you that it does feel like, I don't know whether to trust it. But also, it's not so easy to say that he's acting or he's not acting.
No, true.
It's a blend. I mean, he must feel something. He has nightmares. Yeah. You can't witness that or be a part of that without somehow internalizing it. But it's been so many years, and there was so much repetition of it, that I don't think you can easily parcel out and say, you know what, now that I look back on that, that was wrong. And it's very fluid.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the movie is smart in that way. And I think a movie understands that. I think the title of the film's important. It's The Act of Killing. And there's a sense in which that's just a very basic, this is what it's like to kill. And we get a lot of that in the movie. But it's also a movie about acting in a particular way. It's about, how one acts and what it's like to act and to put up a front, to put up a sense of bravado, a sense of, to act a part. I think the movie is full of that in ways that are thought-provoking and compelling. So
yeah, you mentioned Herzog, and it reminds me of a movie he made called The White Diamond, about a guy who's making these airships that sort of float over the jungle, and they see lots of neat things because of their unusual vantage point. And he's the guy who builds these, I can't remember his name, but he's a real talker, and he really loves to sort of explain what he's doing as if he's a mad scientist kind of a guy.
Yep.
And Herzog, of course, loves to capture that and lets him talk. But he also does this weird thing where he lets the guy almost have a monologue, and then the guy's done, and he stops, and he just keeps looking at the camera, waiting for Herzog to say, all right, cut, or that's the end. And he doesn't. Right. He sits there and holds for seconds while we're waiting for something. And it just reveals the theatricality of the whole thing, because the guy isn't having a conversation. He's not saying, so what do you think? He's got a performance, and he's done the performance, and he's waiting for the curtain to come down.
Yeah, right.
And Herzog is not letting it come down just yet.
Well, I
asked Herzog about that in, it was like the second episode of this podcast way back when, we were children, when we did this that long ago. And he didn't, he's always hard to pin down on why he does any technique, and he didn't have anything revealing to say, but it sticks in my mind that he did that.
I think also, and one of the things I've always loved about Herzog, and I love it about really most great documentarians, is that they have a sense of the possibilities of waiting, of sort of letting sort of uncomfortable silence hang there. Because often then what follows that is actually the most interesting thing. And how people will react in that sort of, moment of like, because people sort of feel the need to fill that space.
Yeah.
And when they do, then there you are. And to go back to this scene that I do find a little bit, false isn't maybe the right word, but it doesn't quite work for me, an act of killing, is here the director wants to sort of, he has these questions, right? He has these questions that he thinks are going to provoke this kind of response. And it's very clear that's what he's going for. And there's a lack of patience with just sort of letting silence sit there and then see what sort of response comes from that. Whereas like with Steve James's movies, Steve James does that a lot too, where there's these sort of long, uncomfortable pauses. And then someone starts talking. It's not the first part. The first part sort of what was on the surface, but what comes after the pause becomes really, really deep. And then we actually see that a lot in Act of Killing, but not at that scene. That scene, because the director really knows he needs something or wants something in particular, it feels a little bit orchestrated, at least for me.
Yeah, I think it works as if you see it that way. If you see it as a necessary or as a desired cap for this story, but right. not if you take it at face value. I think you have to have a little bit of distance and understanding of what the structure of the movie, and maybe it was even unintentional that you see it that way, but mm-hmm. it will. It's followed by they revisit one of the scenes where he did a lot of the killing, and there is. It seems to make Anwar physically ill.
Yeah.
To rethink to be in this spot again after having done the recreations and seen that cut and been through that. If we're to trust the chronology of the movie, and he's basically retching for a long time.
Yeah.
And that, to your point, is left in and not interrupted by some talking or can we get you some water? Or
something,
you know, let's pause this. No, let's see how long this is going to go.
Yeah.
Which is a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, don't know how real it is. We don't. I mean, it's hard to say.
No, I think that's right.
I was thinking of Jean Rouch has a movie called A Chronicle of a Summer made in the was it early 60s maybe? Could be late 50s. I think it was early 60s. We'll have to look this up later. But Jean Rouch was an ethnographic filmmaker. Right. It's kind of an old-fashioned term, but he's a French filmmaker who ended up spending most of the last 30, 40 years of his life in Africa. Mm. Various countries in Africa and trying to empower the people there with cinema. Mm-hmm. He really had a very high belief of film as a power that is useful to people. Give them, the people who live there, cameras. Yeah. Let people document their own lives. Let's help them to tell stories. Mm-hmm. But before he did that, he made this movie called The Chronicle of a Summer, which was just about some people living in France. And the idea was how can we actually capture daily life, normal life on film? Mm. It's sort of the term direct cinema came from this.
Oh, yeah.
This experiment that he did where he and Edgar Morin, I think it was Morin, I can't remember the other, his co-director's name. They just talk to people about their lives and ask them, are you happy in Paris? What's your life like? They follow people around. You get a dozen or so people. You get a sort of little snapshots of their lives.
Yeah.
But then the sort of groundbreaking thing that he did was he showed them a cut of the film and filmed their responses.
Okay.
And that's in the movie.
Ah.
And so you get to see an internal critique.
Interesting.
Were we correctly represented? How did the camera's presence affect us? Some of us were, I felt like she was kind of acting there.
Yeah.
Or I felt like she was speaking in generalities and normally you wouldn't speak that way. She was sort of using this highfalutin talk that I don't think she would have if the camera weren't there. Mm. Where there's this other person who just seemed to completely forget or not care about the camera, was very open, but almost too open. It felt like we were too close to this situation, and it's embarrassing. We wouldn't see this in our real lives, but the camera has allowed us to see into something that's maybe too intimate.
Mm.
And so I thought about that because there are echoes of that in this movie, The Act of Killing, when he shows them the cut of this, and we wonder how they'll respond. But we're so many years removed from this, and cameras have become reality TV.
Sure.
Documentary filmmaking has become such a part of our lives that, as these guys remind us often, movies are just infused in everything that we're doing. And so there are many more layers now than there were then, because it's not that they aren't aware that the camera's there. Their whole project is about we're doing something for the cameras. And
no, I mean, they want to see themselves in a Scorsese film.
Yeah.
Yeah. They want to, they hope to sort of take this persona that they've created on the streets and, you know, sort of bring it to its fullest conclusion, and you know, in a movie about their activities.
Yeah.
So it's funny you mentioned that. I was just in a art gallery yesterday, and it was a photography exhibit that a guy had done, where he'd taken photographs like 25, 30 years ago in this poor neighborhood outside of Bloomington, Indiana, called Pigeon Hill. And sort of provoked by a news event, a horrible news event, he decided to sort of go back and try to find some of these people he had photographed some 25 years ago. And how he did this was he's always done this where he takes photographs and then sort of writes on the photograph. But this time what he did was he took the original photograph that he had made of these people and asked them to try to remember where they were, try to remember what was going on in their life at this point. And then he took another photograph, and how they responded to the first photograph, he would then write on the second photograph. And so in the gallery, these two photographs, these pairs, these diptychs were put together, and they were fascinating. You know, this idea, because some of the people, I mean, you could just tell even 25 years later, that's that person. Others of them, though, I mean, time had made them very different. And but that sense of coming back, you know, trying to go, oh, that's right, that's what was going on in my life at that point. That's what happened to that person. And sometimes the person had died in the meantime. And it's like, oh, that's right, that person died then. And it was very powerful. It was, and I didn't connect it at all to active killing until you just talked about it. But that sense of, it was an attempt at document, and a sense to give story to people in a static framework. Mm-hmm. And yet, by sort of writing on the actual photographs with these stories, it also then gave a sense of narrative and a sense of span of time that was quite compelling. In a strange sort of way, and as I walked out of the gallery, I was walking home, and I was thinking to myself, I feel like I know those people, but I'm not sure that's valid.
Yeah,
I'm not sure it's valid that just seeing two photographs 25 years apart and having sort of their own story written on it gives me that much insight. But it felt like it had.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like I knew them in ways that were pretty compelling and made me think, oh, wow, what would it be like to grow up like that? Or what would it be like to lose a child that way or whatever? And I think when we confront a two-hour documentary, even one as well-made as Active Killing, it's always tricky. You know, how well do I know these people? You know, how well do I know this situation? How much of this is acting? How much of it is not acting? And is there any difference between you know, those two things?
Yeah, well, the act of documenting is just inaccurate and messy. And so it's interesting to try to document the act of documenting.
Yes, it is.
And then to document that as well. Yeah. And you can see where things get disturbed or where things become something other than we thought they were originally. And I know what you mean about sort of feeling like you know people that you've sort of seen snippets of for a little while. And that's, I suppose that's the power of fiction. That's to sort of get a snapshot of a life and think about it in relation to your own or in terms of your own, not necessarily to identify with the people there, but to compare and contrast and sort of get a sense of how other people live. Mm. But it is a danger to feel like you fully know them when you don't. You've received a very constructed view of what their life is, no matter how, no matter what the filmmaker or artist's or author's intentions were.
Yeah, yeah. And we see this in Active Killing, too. There's a couple of scenes where they are, again, preparing to shoot a scene. One takes place in a house where they're sort of, Herman is trying to tell people how you should act when people come to take you away and, you know, how to be scared, basically. And so you have adults who are doing this and are able to kind of distance themselves. You know, when they start screaming, you can tell that they actually are acting. But the children, when the children start screaming, you can tell that they don't have that distance. For them, they can't quite understand what it means to act.
Yeah.
And it is, it's really disturbing. It's disturbing to sort of watch that happen because somehow you get even a more real, again, where it's complicated, but an even more real sense of the horror of what happened, you know, over the course of those 20, 30 years.
Yeah, one of the most vivid scenes near the end is full set, special effects and fire. They're burning down a village and houses, and they have a full cast of extras there, and one of the guys says he didn't know it would be this way, or he would feel this way about it. Now that he sees the women and children there who are visibly upset, some of the children you mentioned are crying, and there was fire, and the way this film presents it, it's all edited together as if it were an action film. You know? So I don't know sort of in what it was like to stand there and see it, but it must have been sort of similar and chaotic.
Mm.
And it's easier to see it differently when it's just in your head or it's just edited to your clean, clear view of it. But when it's messy and big like that and you see how it affects people who don't have all of your context, it almost pulls you out of your bubble.
Yeah, it does. No, that's a good way of saying it. And then that always brings, documentaries are such really powerful ways of trying to understand our world. And yet, as with any kind of narrative, or it's flawed. You know, there's a limit to what it can do, and it shapes how we understand things, but maybe it shapes it too much sometimes. I think particularly with this kind of film, there's a real danger of that, because it's really easy for a film that wants to chronicle evil to end up like all the other films that chronicle evil. And it wins awards. It makes me feel better about myself. I don't know. That's a weird thing. I mean, I feel better because I watched it. It seems odd to me. And yet I think that's true. Somehow, even though I clearly have nothing to do with making that situation better, the fact that I think I somehow understand it makes me feel better. And I'm not sure what to think of that.
It's hard to know what's been accomplished. If you want to figure out how am I different after having seen this. Yeah. I've thought about a little more about this particular period of time and place that I didn't know a lot about, sold out, but I know a little bit. And it's clear also that it's ongoing in many ways. You mentioned the paramilitary groups. There's a guy who's sort of a leader of a paramilitary youth group there, and he is like a movie star. When he comes in, the paparazzi are taking his picture, and he acts like he knows he's a movie star. Yep. He walks around and struts for cameras and things. Yep. And this is deeply ingrained in the structures of a thing like that, and it's not something that a little documentary like this will do much to dent,
But it's interesting that you bring that up, because for me, maybe the most compelling moment in the film is the closing credits, because so many of the people in the closing credits are anonymous.
Yeah.
And it's just this word anonymous over and over and over again. And you sort of realize that for a lot of people, making this film was a dangerous act. You know, that even though the people who are ostensibly the protagonists are comfortable being there, Oppenheimer and the rest of the sort of the Western crew sort of understand that for a lot of the people, this could have repercussions. You know, this could be seen as deeply, offensive is the word, but transgressive. Yeah. And that sense obviously it gets shown in Western theaters, it gets consumed by a Western audience. But maybe the impact in Indonesia is quite different than the impact that it would have, say, in a movie theater in Chicago. And clearly it does, because for a lot of people, they didn't feel comfortable putting their name on it.
Line producer anonymous, 3 camera operators anonymous. Yeah, just down the line, it's very weird. I don't remember ever seeing anything like that before.
No.
And I'm sure it was sort of structured. You could have done sort of non-traditional credits to just list the people who participated. Instead, he stuck with the strict traditional structure so that you could see the gaps, basically. Yep. And actually, the first credit I believe that appears, his might be first, but then there's characters, and he lists the people who've been the subjects of the film, Anwar and Ehrman, and to label them as characters I thought was interesting too.
That's true. Why do you think he does that? What's the reason for that?
Well, they are the characters of the movie. I mean, they are characters in so many ways. They're sort of characters in the thing they're constructing. They are characters in that they are bigger than life and hard to believe and hard to imagine that these people walk the earth and they are acting in some way. They are doing an act of killing, and so in that sense, they're characters.
Yeah, that's profound. The movie is really smart. I think the movie is really self-aware of what it's trying to do, and at times the limitations of what it can do. But it also is just some of the footage that Oppenheimer and the others get is like, wow. Going back to that opening sequence kind of comes back to me a lot with the people in front of this waterfall. And I remember watching it in the theater, because I didn't really know what the rest of the movie was going to be about. I went in pretty unaware. And, it's these people who look kind of uncomfortable, and they're supposed to look happy. And that clearly is the case. It's supposed to be some sort of happy scene. And then there's this off-screen voice,
Don't let the camera catch you looking bad.
That's right. Less fake. But again, that sense of, I think also you get that, in a society in which, things are so tightly controlled, there's real danger in not acting the right way. And you can sort of see that on people's faces, that is it okay for me to act like this? And so even sort of identity gets constructed that way, I think, and sort of really disturbing ways.
Yeah, the movie actually opens with a quote from Voltaire. It is forbidden to kill, therefore all murderers are punished, unless they kill in large numbers and to the sound of trumpets.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of rationalization in the movie. Yeah. At one point, it feels like he sort of pricks the skin of this guy as they're driving around in a car and says, yeah. You know, what if The Hague called you? What if you were brought up on war crimes tomorrow? Yeah. And he has all of these rationalizations that, well, I mean, you'd have to start with Cain and Abel. And the Americans killed the Indians. Yeah. And Guantanamo was good under Bush, and now it's bad. It's just that the war crimes is defined by the winners. We are the winners, so we get to define what war crimes are. I mean, it has a little string of them. It's just a list of rationalizations that do broaden this to geopolitics in a way that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, but it's clear in that scene that he doesn't quite believe those. You know,
otherwise, why would he need so many of them?
That's right. That's right. He's, his rationalizations, they sort of fall flat. They're useful in certain ways. They're ways of deflecting. But, because that guy is really interesting. I forget his name. Adi, maybe? Anyway, but he's similar to Anwar and Herman, but he doesn't buy into what they're doing. He thinks, why are you doing this? Just let it lie. I don't think you should go back. And so, as Oppenheimer's in the car and you sort of hear his voice sort of asking these questions, he's getting under the skin of this guy who, might have been even worse than the other two. You can tell that he's comfortable with what he's done, but he's not comfortable talking about what he's done. And that's, for him, there's a distinction between those two things.
Yeah. There's also a reporter who worked for the newspaper, and we've already seen the guy who was the publisher, who it seems that a lot of the interrogations were done at the newspaper, and then he basically said, yeah, we talked to that guy, that guy's a communist, and then take him away and kill him. Yeah. So he had a lot to do with who got killed. He was sort of the filter. And one of the reporters, he's an ex-reporter, he's standing there watching one of the recreations, and afterward he says, wow, you guys were, now that I see this, you guys were so smooth, I didn't know any of this was going on. And they start questioning him, now wait a minute, how could you have worked there? How could you have not known this?
Yeah.
And it seems clear that he's, creating this distance.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it would be, I've just been, to take it back to sort of an obvious reference with Nazi Germany. I've just been reading a book called The Book Thief, the book that they turned into a movie, which I haven't seen. But the book is actually quite powerful in that it's, it takes place in Germany and sort of the lead up to the rise of the Nazis and then the sort of the early and middle years of the war. But just, what it is like to live in that kind of situation where awful things are being done and yet you feel somewhat powerless to do anything about them. And even any sort of moment of trying to, counteract what's going on is met ruthlessly. It's interesting to think of people in that middle space, people who weren't necessarily outright perpetrators, but people who weren't victims, somehow take on the awful aspects of both. There's a way in which they are still perpetrating the system because they're not able to do anything about it, or they don't do anything about it. But then they're also in certain ways victims because they're put in this, horribly untenable position. And the whole society becomes, sort of perverted by what's going on. I know that's a very simple way of sort of describing it, but I've been reading The Book Thief. I've been thinking about The Act of Killing and other movies that deal with that kind of society, and the whole society becomes. To bring it back to 12 Years a Slave, which is a movie I just saw a couple weeks ago. Finally, that's a movie that also I think really smartly sort of shows how slavery enters into every single part of the fabric of society and warps every single part of it. It's not just that, slavery itself is awful, which it absolutely is, but it's that every part of society then becomes infected by the awfulness of it. And I think that movie is quite smart about doing that or showing that. So.
Have you seen any good movies lately?
12 Years a Slave I thought was solid. Hopefully I won't offend anyone. I was telling you earlier, Rob, that I was a little surprised at how middlebrow it was, given that Steve McQueen is the director. I really think Hunger is a fantastic film, but that film is really rigorous. And 12 Years a Slave is, it's really pretty. We have lots of landscape shots of the South. It's very, very beautiful in that way. And at times I was thinking, why are we seeing this sunset? I'm not sure what's going on here. But the acting is great. And but the movie I was thinking about, I hadn't thought about it until you started talking about Jean Rouch. Is that how I'm pronouncing it? You know, I saw this movie a few weeks back called On the Bowery, which is a 56 film. It's like a 65-minute. I think IMDb actually listed as a documentary, but it's not really. It's but it is. It's also ethnography. It's kind of a weird mix, but it's about these alcoholics who live in the Bowery, and the main character is a guy who's been working somewhere else, and he comes in to the Bowery. Just it seems like he's just kind of in between jobs, and he just kind of lands there. But his old alcoholism sort of comes back with a vengeance, and he's pretty quickly just, you know, lost all the money that he made working. But a lot of the actors in the movie were drunks, you know, Bowery bums. And so the movie is and there's long scenes where it's just, you know, scenes of people in a bar or scenes of people at a kind of a shelter, or scenes of them on the street. And so there's this sort of thread of a story that goes through it, particularly around this one guy and whether he's going to be able to get out of the Bowery. But it's really a thoughtful, well-made documentary / fiction film. So I found that quite compelling and a really strong sense of place in sort of, you know, middle of New York City.
Is that a new movie?
No, 56. Okay. And made in a kind of a style that I don't think would occur to people to make anymore, because it is this weird mix of document and fiction. And it's pretty clearly at times structured like a narrative, but then pretty clearly other times we're just sort of fly on the wall in this bar watching people get drunk and argue. So, but strangely compelling both as story and as document. So how about you? What have you seen?
Well, I rewatched The Master, which I saw last year, and probably because Philip Seymour Hoffman died recently, and I was thinking that may be his last great film.
Yeah.
And also because we had just seen her, and Joaquin Phoenix was great in that, and also great in The Master.
Yes.
Not someone I probably would have predicted years ago. What was the first movie I saw him in? Probably Gus Van Sant's To Die For.
Oh, okay.
Where he was really good, but seemed like just that guy.
Yeah, right.
But to imagine that guy might also be a great actor many years later, and a quirky and unusual presence on film, was pretty cool. And that movie is dense and satisfying, and I liked it just as well this time.
Yeah, that scene early on in the film where I forget the characters' names, but where Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman sort of have that interrogation, that scene is amazing. You know, it's riveting for, you know, I don't know how long it is, but it goes on for a while.
Yeah,
I was surprised at how sad I was about his death. And people die and sometimes in really, you know, tragic ways, but I don't know, that seems like such an enormous loss for film. I just don't think I've seen a movie where he wasn't great. And I was, you know, it's funny, this is probably another podcast down the road, but, you know, to watch a lot of movies, part of it is to fall in love with actors, right? To think to yourself, I get to watch this person maybe for another 30 years, another 40 years maybe. I'm going to watch this person grow old. I'm going to watch this person sort of hopefully develop and understand more about life and communicate more about life. And just think that, you know, we won't get to see that with Philip Seymour Hoffman. It strikes me as genuinely sad.
I think I tend to devalue acting as an art because it's held up to such high accolades all the time. Mm. It's front and center when I'm more interested in so many other aspects of the film.
Yep.
And yet there are times when there is an actor who seems to tap into something every single time, and it is clearly an art.
Yeah.
And it's I'm not sure how it's done. It's a mystery, complete mystery to me. And I looked forward to everything he was in.
Yeah.
And he'll be missed.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. To browse our archive of 40 episodes, go to plasticpodcast.com, and there you'll find notes about each one. And we'll be back with number 41. Bye.